Well, thank you, and it's good to be back. Just to clarify one thing, we're headquartered in New York, which is a city that not only plays baseball, but excels at it.
Hey, easy.
Usually it takes me a few minutes to alienate the crowd, but I see we're ahead of schedule today, so that's good. That's efficient. Thank you for coming out on this glorious day. And it's glorious in part because of the weather, in part because it's Veterans Day. And as Bob said, it is a day to stop and give thanks to those who give so much. What I'm going to do is talk for a few minutes about the challenges facing this country and this president, the 44th president. And then we'll save the bulk of our time for what you all have on your mind. I've been thinking about how to divide the challenges, how to summarize them, because I can't go through each one of them, or it would be about a five-hour talk, because there are a lot of them. There are a lot of them by any standard. Indeed, you know, when you take a step back for a second, you've got to be struck by the range and scale of the problems that Mr. Obama must find each day in that inbox of his when he gets up in the morning and walks into the Oval Office. But three in particular stand out, and that's what I wanted to talk about. The first is obviously the economic. And the economic challenges are so important because unless you get the economic foundations right, almost by definition, you don't get a lot else right. And it's the foundations for the United States and America as an economy, as a society. It provides the resources for all we do in the world. And I would simply say, to make a very long story short, that the administration has succeeded at one thing but not at another. And the administration, or more generally the United States, has succeeded, I believe, in getting us off the edge or the ledge, which is where we were essentially a year ago. And if you read any one of these books that have come out, which kind of give you what Inside the Beltway is called the TikTok of the economic or financial crisis of a year ago, we were stunningly close to some sort of an economic meltdown. And even though not everything that was done in retrospect is necessarily perfect, I would simply say, putting on my public policy hat, it was mentioned that I've written a book about management, I actually think that what some of the people did at the time was quite heroic. And I know it's fashionable to criticize public servants, and again, it's easy to focus in on their mistakes. But some of what was done was heroic. There was no playbook for it. They were making it up as they went along. The Secretary of the Treasury, the Chairman of the Fed, and some others were given a degree of latitude and discretion that is quite stunning. And I would just simply say, as a society, as a country, we are better off for unbalanced the choices they made. And the fact that we're having the economic and healthcare and other debates we're having now is something of a luxury, because had they not done what they did, I think we'd be having, if you will, much more fundamental conversations about what to do to get this economy back on the rails. We're on the rails, which is the good news. The bad news is some of the direction we're heading in isn't so good. And that's the real economic challenge. And above all, it's the deficit, which accumulates as debt. You know you're in trouble when the headlines a few weeks ago are good news, that the deficit for the coming year is only going to be $1.4 trillion. That's my short definition of how you know you're in trouble. And yes, the United States needs to run something of a deficit in order to provide stimulus to an economy here and to provide liquidity to the world. But there's such a thing as too much of a good thing. And we are now running far, far too much of a deficit. And it's essentially because our spending is beyond our means. And I, for one, do not believe we are undertaxed. I would simply say that the bigger problem is on the spending side, but we as a society have not been able to agree on what we need to do differently, where we need to spend more slowly or spend less. And I would think that this is probably unsustainable. It was Herb Stein, Mr. Nixon's economic advisor, who once opined quite sagely that which cannot go on forever won't. I've always been impressed by economists. I don't know about the rest of you. And but it can't. And it leaves us to some extent vulnerable to the willingness of central banks in China and elsewhere around the world to continue to provide deficit financing. So the question is, at any point, will we face a situation where strings are attached? I don't know. It also, though, raises questions that even if it's not central banks, simply millions of decision makers around the world, whether at some point we're going to be forced to raise our interest rates in order to provide the finance that we need. And obviously the nightmare for the Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Fed and Larry Summers and everybody else who's involved is that we would need to be, we're forced to raise our interest rates in order to attract foreign financing sooner than we want at a point where it could actually threaten American economic recovery. Now, it may turn out that we get the sequence right and we find essentially Goldilocks is alive and well in Washington, which would be wonderful news. But it's also quite possible that we don't get it right, where that we're forced to do certain things in order to, again, attract the necessary financing sooner than we would want, or more have to raise rates at a more rapid rate than we would want. And the best way I know to avoid that situation is for the United States now not to get rid of the deficit. If we were to do that, that would a screeching halt would thrust us into deep recession or depression. But what the world is looking for is a signal that we are essentially getting this under control. And if we're looking at a $1.4 trillion deficit, the world's probably looking for something on the order of $100, $150 billion a year of deficit reduction and a realistic trajectory, not phony cuts that are projected, but cuts that look real. And unless there is that kind of a signal, I believe that the sense of economic recovery, the high stock market and all that will simply be something of a respite between economic crises. So that's challenge number one, is putting the economy on a long-term trajectory of sustainable growth. Set of problems number two are the problems that define this era internationally. Every era has its defining problems. The previous century, first half of it was essentially the struggle for supremacy in Europe, Germany, France, Britain, what have you, in Asia, Japan and others. United States obviously joining the fray. And then the second half of the 20th century, the great struggle is the Cold War. And just this past week, we celebrated the 20th anniversary of the end of it with the 11/9, which was the day 20 years ago that the Berlin Wall came down. Well, the defining struggle, I would think, in this century is not that. It's not a replay of great power conflict. Mercifully, it's certainly not happening now, and it's certainly not inevitable that it does happen. But instead, the great challenges of this year are global challenges. It's the spread of nuclear materials and nuclear weapons. It's people like Pat and the spread of H1N1. only kidding. It is climate change. It is it's the fact that carbon emissions are raising. The average temperature on the planet, and that this will have all sorts of consequences for the quality of life and economic prosperity. It's energy questions, that there's as one looks out into the future, and here we are in Dallas, that there's a mismatch between likely demand for energy and the availability of supplies, particularly oil and gas. It's terrorism. And what all these things have in phenomenon, all these phenomena have in common is that they're global, and essentially the world is not Las Vegas. What happens anywhere will not stay there, but to the contrary, what happens anywhere will spread everywhere. And whether it's computer viruses or human viruses, whether it's dollars, whether it's drugs, whether it's guns, whether it's uranium or what have you, that this stuff spreads. Often governments don't know about it. Even when they know about it, they can't often control it. And coming up with the mechanisms for dealing with this is the great challenge. And I would simply say there's a gap right now. Here we are, 2009. There's a gap in the nature, scale, quantity, and quality of these global challenges and the arrangements the world has in place to deal with them. It's not surprising. Most of the arrangements the world has in place go back 50, 60 years. A lot of these ideas were hatched during or shortly after World War II. But it's this gap between global challenges and global arrangements, the organizations, the rules, and so forth, that is quite alarming. And I would simply say one of the ways to think about foreign policy, the business that we're in, and indeed it's the biggest single project we have going on at the Council on Foreign Relations, is what is needed to close that gap. What sort of arrangements need to be put in place to deal with financial flows, to deal with trade, to deal with nuclear proliferation, to deal with terrorism, to deal with disease, to deal with energy, to deal with climate change. And that's the second batch of issues. And our ability to close this gap between the challenges and the institutions, rules, arrangements, what have you, will define in many ways the character and quality of the next few decades, probably the first half of the 21st century. Which leads me to the third set of problems. It's good you had your lunch. I hope you're now just starting your dessert, because this is the best part. As if the economic and the global are not enough. The third set of problems is actually, in some ways, the most familiar. And it's a geographic set of problems, and it's the greater Middle East. It's the part of the world that stretches from North Africa through the so-called Levant, Israel and its neighbors, to the Persian Gulf, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and so forth, all the way through the subjects du jour, Afghanistan and Pakistan. And it's this part of the world that has been, is, and is likely to remain the most problematic for the United States and the world. It's nothing new. When you think back at the last half dozen or so presidents, one of the few things they have in common is almost every one of them had to deal with problems and serious problems in this part of the world. So that's simply a effective life. And what's also interesting to me is when you compare the greater Middle East to the rest of the world, it stands out, but not in the way you'd want it to stand out. Europe, which was the great center of geopolitical competition for much of the previous century, now the biggest debate in Europe is how often people meet in Brussels. That's what we call a good problem. Europeans have just signed on to the so-called Lisbon Treaty. Europe's becoming much more integrated. Ronald Reagan said his goal was to make Europe largely whole and free. Well, we've largely done that. And Europe, as a result, is boring. But boring's good. But that's that. It's highly prosperous, highly democratic, and so forth. Asia. Asia is extraordinary. Asia is now the locus, the locale of the great dynamism of the 21st century. In the United States, you know, we've been shrinking until this last quarter economically. For the first half of this year, while we were shrinking, Europe was shrinking economically, the average growth rate in Asia was between 5 and 6%. China is going to probably be close to double digits. India will be up around there again. The great poverty reduction accomplishments of history have happened in Asia over the last couple of decades. And what's so amazing to me is you've got all this economic dynamism, China, India, even Japan, despite its own drift, Vietnam, Korea, what have you, without war. Because so much of history is about the friction that's inevitably caused when dynamism and growth overwhelm political circuits. And Asia, the fact that you've had all this growth, and yet the countries have largely accommodated themselves to one another, not perfectly and not totally, but not bad. It's quite an extraordinary accomplishment. And in the process, it's not only avoided major conflict for the last couple of decades, but it's become more integrated economically and more open politically. And it's interesting, here's President Obama is about to take off to go to Asia, to go to Japan, to go to Singapore for the Asian economic, the regional economic talks, to go to China, to go to Korea. But whatever problems we have there, and obviously we have problems and challenges there, but still, I would put them in the class of good problems. It's quite a remarkable accomplishment when one looks at how vibrant and yet how relatively stable Asia is. Latin America and Africa, quickly again, for all their questions, not bad. Latin America, again, largely at peace, more open economically and politically than it was a generation ago. Again, not perfect. You have challenges, among other things, of Chavez in Venezuela, uncertainties in Honduras, the lingering reality of communism in Cuba, but pretty impressive. When one thinks about what Latin America looked like a generation or two ago, how repressive it was politically and so forth. And then Africa, again, a mixed story for sure. But again, for every negative, there's a positive. And even a place that would say the reality of the most negative of Africa, a place like Rwanda today, is quite an impressive flourishing society, and amazing compared to what it was just over a decade ago. So again, I don't want to sugarcoat it or whitewash it, but not bad. But it's the greater Middle East that stands out quite poorly. And it's quite a basket. So within the inbox, the part of the inbox that says Greater Middle East has quite a few things in it. And I won't go in detail, but just to basically rattle them off. You've got Iran, which has nuclear ambitions. The talks that were started just over a month ago have already run into major hiccups. It's not clear that the Iranians meant what they said, and even if they meant what they said, that still wouldn't solve the problem. What makes it more complicated is not just their nuclear ambitions, but it's trying to figure out a policy to try to rein in their, put a place a ceiling on their nuclear ambitions in a way that the Chinese and Russians and others will support, but also in a way that does not nip in the bud a very promising political dynamic in Iran, which in some ways is the most exciting political development in that part of the world, which at least for the first time in 30 years has challenged the Islamic Republic. And you know, I often used to tell my students when I taught that at Harvard that foreign policy is hard. This is hard. How does one, again, try to rein in, cap the Iranian nuclear program at a level we can accept it, they can accept it, but do so in a way that does not stop what has the promise to change the character of that society and government? One problem. Second is Iraq. Iraq is due to have elections in a couple of months. Developments this week, not bad. National political law, election law agreed to. But still, lots of things that have to happen. We still have 100,000 troops there. And I would simply say the fundamental question is whether these troops can leave over the next 2 years and have stability remain in their wake. Not obvious to me. And it's quite possible that who's ever elected in Iraq and the Obama administration may have to reconsider the plans for the future of U.S. Forces there. But I'm unpersuaded. We were just talking about it at the table. I'm unpersuaded that Iraq is on a self-sustaining trajectory. Things would not unravel to some extent if the U.S. forces were to leave. Third challenge is the Israeli-Palestinian challenge, also Israel-Syria, Israel-Lebanon. It has been a bad 9-10 months for that. Just when you think things can't get worse, they do, and they have. And you have right now the situation in the Middle East, which is about as unripe as you ever get it, given the divisions and weaknesses on the Palestinian side, the orientations of the Israeli government. The one good news in the Middle East, in this area, in the Israeli-Palestinian area, is what's going on the ground in the West Bank. And you actually have an economy in the West Bank that's probably growing somewhere north of 5% a year. Just today in the paper, there were stories about new telecom company and so forth. There's stuff happening there. Day-to-day life is improving. Capacities are building. But this is the slow process, ground up, of trying to build a state or the essence of a state. It's not clear it will succeed. In the meantime, what's going on in Gaza is in many ways going in the opposite direction. And the idea of how to still broker, how the United States, the prospects for brokering peace and a deal that is so desperately needed by everybody, by Israelis, if Israel is going to remain a safe, Jewish, democratic, prosperous state, as well as for Palestinians so they can have a decent future, getting from here to there, I would simply say, however far here is from there, it's gotten farther over the last year. You've got Bob Jordan here, we've got succession questions and in places like Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Again, it's not that either of these societies is on the edge of a crisis. But I would say neither one of these societies has worked out the mechanics of smooth and legitimate succession. Perhaps just as important, neither one of these societies, particularly Egypt, has worked out the question of what is the nature of the society and country. And as if all this wasn't enough, you then got the problem of Afghanistan and Pakistan. I would simply say that Pakistan is our most troubling foreign policy crisis. In my first meeting with Colin Powell, it's almost now 9 years ago, when he had just been announced as secretary and he called me and asked if I would be the head of policy planning. We spent about an hour and a half in his office talking about it. He said, well, what haven't we talked about? What worries you most at night? And I said, that's easy, Pakistan. And it was then, it is now. It's the part of the world where the gap or disparity between our interests and our influence is the largest. Here's this country that has, you know, plus or minus 100 nuclear weapons, 175 million people. It sits up against Afghanistan. It sits up against India. It's host to the world's most dangerous and powerful terrorist organizations, and our ability to influence it is modest. And we agreed to give them $7.5 billion recently, and most of the reaction was critical with the conditions that were attached to it. So working out a relationship with Pakistan, it seems to me, is easier to describe than do. And in the meantime, we've obviously got on our plate the question of Afghanistan and what to do about it. The president called Afghanistan a war of necessity. It's not. It's a war of choice. It's not clear to me our interests there are vital. We have a whole range or menu of options about how to proceed in the military sphere as well as in the non-military sphere. I would simply say, and one of the reasons I think it's taking the president so long to come to a conclusion is that the options that are available are truly unappetizing. There is no option out there that promises rewards that are commensurate with our investment. And that is the shorthand for the problem. And so trying to figure out just what it is, what's a realistic set of goals, what's a level of involvement that makes sense given those stakes, is again easier described than implemented, and that's where the president is right now, and that's where his administration is, wrapped around the axle of an extraordinarily difficult decision in which whichever course we go in, whatever level of military forces we introduce, whatever it is we do or don't do, it will be an imperfect outcome given, I think, the political and cultural and historical realities that is Afghanistan. So that's what's in his inbox. Economic, global, greater Middle East. Every once in a while, when I used to brief all the candidates during the campaign, and I do a watered-down version of this, and I always say, you sure you want this job? And clearly everybody did. I think there are two positive things, just so no one takes their shoelaces and use them in unintended ways here. The first is what I alluded to before, which is amidst these problems, the fact that the 21st century is largely free of the problems which defined the 20th century, which was great power war, means that not only do we avoid the cost of that, which would be terrible and worse, but it means that the possibility exists for great power cooperation to deal with lots of what I've talked about, to deal with economic problems, to deal with global problems, to deal with the greater Middle East. And we're seeing that on occasion. We're seeing what you might call selective or limited areas of cooperation between and among United States, China, Japan, Russia, India, Brazil, what have you. And again, the challenge is to make it more frequent. But again, compared to some of the 20th century's problems, you look at these problems and you go, not bad, and we do have potentially some partners for dealing with them. The second is when I look at the United States, there's a history of renewal, that this is a dynamic society, and though we face economic problems in particular, we have a history of being able to be creative and innovative and all that. And I would just simply say, my last point, and then I'll stop, is whether that still remains the case. And I would think that the biggest, to me, question mark is whether this society retains the ability to be as adaptive and as creative as it historically has been. And that's not a foreign policy problem. That's a domestic question. And that's a question of our educational institutions. It's a question of our political institutions, including Congress. It's a question of the impact of the internet, of cable television, the rest, about whether we can have political debates in this country where we actually can talk about the problems I've just put out on the table and talk about the possible ways of addressing those problems in a serious, sustained way. And if our politics are up to that, then I'm as optimistic as ever. And if our politics are not up to that, then in a couple of years, we'll have bigger problems to talk about at a lunch in Dallas. So with that, let me stop and let me open it up to you all.
Oh. Will Abdullah Abdullah's withdrawal from the Afghanistan presidential runoff election cause the government to suffer? This is from Olivia Scott at Good Shepherd Episcopal.
Well, the problem in Afghanistan goes way beyond Abdullah Abdullah and his refusal to participate in this, what was to have been a second round of elections. It's the problem of coming up with legitimacy in politics, of getting a partner you can work with who has the legitimacy to ask things of his own population to essentially lead. And the answer is you don't have it. Whether there had been a second round, whether Mr. Abdullah had participated in it, was almost secondary. The fact is that You've got the government you've got. It'll be a second Karzai government. It would have been either way. The real question is who's in it? The real question is what is the constitutional relationship between what goes on in Kabul and what goes on in the rest of the country? It's how well people govern. And I would simply say that history would indicate that one should be somewhat modest in one's ambitions here. And then the question is for the United States, how do, and I think this gets to the core of Barack Obama's problem here, which is, okay, we don't want Afghanistan to become yet again a safe haven for al-Qaeda. We don't want the Taliban to regain control. We don't want it to continue to produce 90% of the world's poppy and so forth. On the other hand, how do we get them to do things? And to what extent do we just do things ourselves? To what extent do we condition what we do on what it is they're prepared to do? And that is our problem, which is there's limits to what we can and should do, and there's the limits to what they will do. And how we figure out, again, what's the right level and right kind of American involvement in Afghanistan, and how do we... The whole goal is that we do more in the short run, so they will build up the capacity and the will to do more in the medium and long run. That's the idea behind what General McChrystal and others talk about. It's not obvious to me that concept will work. That means that by doing more in the short run, we can build up capacities and change the political culture, so we then have enduring Afghan capabilities and willingness to look after their own country in ways they haven't done. I simply say, to walk into the Oval Office and say, if we do X, Y, and Z militarily, economically, and politically, and we will have all these long-term benefits, it would take a confident person to walk into the Oval Office and make that case. I could not do it. Yes, ma'am.
I believe, thank you so much for your presentation. Oh. That's
thank you. Do you want to leave it at that, or do you just want to make a question?
Could you please address energy independence in relation to the three issues that you discussed?
Sure. Let me address it in two ways. One is, I truly dislike the phrase energy independence. It ain't going to happen. It doesn't need to happen. It sets the bar at a level that can never be attained. We're always going to be importing degrees of energy, just like we're going to be importing certain other things. I mean, autarky is not a goal for the American economy. So we don't want to set up energy independence as well. What we want to have is energy efficiency, a reasonable degree of imports for sure. But the most important thing is efficiency. And if you have energy efficiency, then everything else will take care of itself. But it does affect all else. I mean, the fact that we consume as much energy as we do, particularly when we say oil, particularly oil, but also other forms, coal and other things, and import as much as we do, it exacerbates our economic difficulties in terms of the weakness of the dollar, the amount of dollars that are washing around the world. It also, much of it gets into unfortunate hands, and we do end up funding both sides of the global effort on terror. So money's going to governments like Iran and Venezuela, Russia, Saudi Arabia. It doesn't matter necessarily whether we directly import from them, but our demand contributes to world demand, which helps set the world price. So I've often thought that we should get serious about energy policy. It's one of those great public policy areas where if you get it right, you get multiple payoffs. So it's something of a, you'd almost argue, a threefer, that you slow the flow of funds to some undesirable governments. You slow the flow of funds in general, which creates pressures on the dollar. You reduce government expenditures. It leaves you less vulnerable to supply interruptions because of crises. It takes away, say, from the Iranians, certain retaliatory threats if they were to do certain things in the aftermath of some kind of a military strike. And then you've also got the environmental benefits. So you add all this up, and it ought to be, to me, obvious that in terms of public policy, this is one of the areas of highest potential payoff. I would simply say it's something of a scandal that nearly four decades after the first oil crisis, which was at the time of the October 73 Middle East War, we haven't done much. And I would simply say, it's funny, people in my business always stand up and say, what we need in this country is more bipartisanship. This might be an area where we need less bipartisanship. We've had bipartisanship on this issue for 40 years, Republicans, Democrats, presidents, Congress, and we don't have much to show for it. Well, Michael Kinsley once said, you know, what's truly scandalous in Washington is not what's illegal, it's what's legal. This is scandalous. This is scandalous that we have allowed ourselves to be put in this position, and we should do something about it. Yes, ma'am.
Powers in the Middle East, and those have been our two major allies. So one is an oil state, one isn't, but they are both large countries. Who is taking their place? How is the power shift happening? And what do you predict will come from it?
Yeah, for those of you who couldn't hear the first part, there's an article in today's paper about how the countries such as Saudi Arabia and Egypt, which over the years have been closer to the American quote-unquote camp, generally grouped with moderates, even though they're both authoritarian, are feeling uncomfortable with the flow of things in the region, and they're worried about the relative gains of Iran, Syria, Hamas, Hezbollah, which is essentially the Iranian axis in the Middle East, and they should be worried. And all things being equal, over the, you know, one of the consequences of the second Iraq war was that we created a Middle East in which Iranian influence again manifested in places like Syria to some extent, but certainly Hezbollah and Hamas is much stronger. So we've, you know, we removed the Iraqi balancer to Iran. So I think all that's true, and they have reason to be worried. And it's just as a side, it's one of the reasons that if Iran does reach a point where it has a nuclear weapon or something awfully close to it, the reactions will not simply be felt or discussed in Israel, but they will also be discussed in places like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and so forth. The Sunni world will have very serious conversations about how to respond to what will be seen as the quote-unquote Iranian or Shia weapon. I would simply say, though, the situations are very different. We've got two former ambassadors to Saudi Arabia here, so I'll tread lightly. But I think in Egypt, actually, the real source of the problem is the lack of quality American representation in Saudi Arabia. And I mean, let's be honest here. Let's be honest. Let's get this on the table here. Egypt, I think, has largely itself to blame. Egypt has been a top-heavy political system now for decades. It ought to be this, you know, a quarter to a third of the Arab world is Egypt. One out of every three or four Arabs is Egyptian. Cairo has historically been the great city of the Arab world, and it's not. And even while there's a little bit of economic activity in Egypt, market activity and the rest, by and large, Egypt's a dreary place. It's a dreary place politically, intellectually, and the rest. So I think Egypt's lost its appeal for much of the Arab world. People don't sit around in cafes or watching televisions talking about Egypt. So I think Egypt's lost a lot of influence, not simply because of a lack of a peace process, results, or anything else. I think Egypt's lost a lot because Egypt itself has not evolved in exciting, interesting ways. Saudi Arabia, it seems to me, again, has never been a model for anything in the region. The real question is how it uses its resources and so forth. I actually think Saudi Arabia, again, is somewhat to blame for its predicament. And here I'll probably raise a few eyebrows. But to me, the most troubling part of Saudi foreign policy is, again, not what's illegal, what's legal. And we've actually been quite successful with the Saudis at shutting down so-called terrorist financing, the money that goes from Saudi Arabia to groups like Al-Qaeda. That's now relatively modest. What we've been wildly unsuccessful at is slowing the flow of funds from Saudi channels, private and public, to mosques, to teaching institutions, and so forth, to basically radicalize, Salafiize, if you prefer, Wahhabiize, if you prefer, the center in the Muslim world. And I think Saudi Arabia has had, in that sense, a destructive effect on the political and religious and social balance within the Arab and Muslim world. So again, when they see radicalism gaining an upper hand, part of me says, physician, heal thyself. That Saudi Arabia has, in part for domestic reasons, where political authorities feel compelled to allow these things to happen, because that's the bargain that's at the core of contemporary Saudi Arabia. I do think that Saudi Arabia has either done or allowed, tolerated certain sorts of activities which have dramatically shifted the balance within the Arab and Muslim worlds in more radical directions. And to me, there's limits to what we as Americans can do. But so the real question, to borrow from Sam Huntington, is if you want to avoid the clash between civilizations, how do you promote a clash within civilizations? How do we get more tolerant, liberal, modernist voices in the Arab and Muslim worlds to step up, to compete with some of these influences? And I think that's the real question. And I wish I could be more positive, but that's the real question. Sir.
It seems to me, Mr. Ambassador, that part of the difficulty that presidents have in executing foreign policy is they're doing so in a country that is largely ignorant and apathetic about international affairs, which in my view gives rise to attacks like that of our former vice president, not the president, a person whom I know you enjoy such a close and loving relationship. So over the course of your career, who have been two or three of the leaders who you think have done the best job of communicating international affairs in a way that the American public gets?
This is as close to a "when did you stop beating your wife" question as I've gotten. And I long ago I learned that if you don't get asked the question you wish you'd been asked, you answer that one in any event. So I'm going to answer the question I wished I'd been asked on this one. One is, I'd simply say, the most extraordinary public figure I've interacted with in the course of my career, which is, what, three or four decades now, is not an American, it's an Israeli, was Yitzhak Rabin. And what was so amazing to me about Rabin was that he was willing to overcome, in some ways, many of his own prejudices, take risks for peace, but he did so reluctantly, and he did so in a way that took the country with him. And to me, that was quite extraordinary, and the sad part is his assassination really made a difference, and I think it actually did have a tremendous impact. But he was, to me, more than any other leader I've worked with closely, one who was willing to have an honest conversation with his own citizenry about why they should contemplate doing things that were very difficult for them to do. And I think part of being successful, particularly in a democracy, is a willingness to carry out a serious public conversation. I thought Barack Obama did it in the campaign, say, about race. I hope he does it about some of these other issues, about coming to terms with globalization, about, we talked about energy. There's lots of issues he could usefully do. The healthcare experience has not, to me, been terribly promising. It's been, to me, a stunningly disappointing debate on all sides of the question. In terms of other things publicly, I'd say the most impressive civil servant I've dealt with over the years, and I don't mean this critical of others, because I've worked with some wonderful people, including one in a city, several in cities not far from here, is Brent Scowcroft, who, as the National Security Advisor, better than anyone else I've worked with, I thought got it right, this balance between, I write about it a lot in this book, War of Necessity, War of Choice, better than anyone else who's had that job before or since, got the balance right between being the guarantor and dispenser of due process, making the system work so the president, in a sense, got what he needed to get, not just what he wanted to get, but also was still a counselor, but never allowed his role as counselor to get in the way of his role as honest broker. And I thought Scowcroft did tremendously valuable service to 41, when 41 was written. I would just simply say I think it's gotten harder, which is it's a little bit what I tried to refer to before, which is our public space has gotten pretty crowded, and it's gotten pretty rough. And I think when I watch I mean, when I grew up, you had, you know, basically three networks, a couple of magazines, a couple of national places. Well, now you've got the whole proliferation of satellite and cable. You've got all sorts of radio. You've got a degree of populism has entered into our public debate, which I think the technology is consistent with. Whether it's, you know, anyone now can become his publisher. You start your own blog. And we can self-select what radio station or TV, whatever, to tune into. So there's much less editing, and there's much less community building, much less consensus building. And I think it's become tougher as a result to have these debates and to build bridging mechanisms. Our parties have gotten weaker. Anyway, I can go on. There's a long list. But I think all things being equal, it's become governing, consensus building, compromising has become more, not less, difficult. And just as an aside, it's interesting. Lots of people would agree with me that the deficit's a real problem. The big debate in Washington is now, everyone, okay, most people agree on that. Well, how do you go about fixing it? And we're not talking about where to make the spending cuts. So there's one group that says the only way you can do it is by doing an end run around the political system, set up some kind of a commission or task force or whatever to do it. And then the system doesn't want to let you do that because the congressional leadership and others are saying, well, hold it. We were elected to do what we were elected to do, so we're not going to allow you to set up an end run. And that, to me, in a nutshell, tells you a little bit what's going on. I think it's very, very tough now to get this country to get serious about the sorts of things. Now, I would just simply say the healthier debate, which has been one of our biggest debates in quite a while, is not a terribly reassuring experience for me, if I may put on my political science hat and speak in, I'd call that understatement on steroids, but sure.
Realizing that we've played willingly the RoboCop for the world for the last 60 years, the Middle East is basically a map created by the British in 1918 to 1922 with a little help of the French. Why are we not trying to co-opt them into joining us in the leadership and solving the problem?
Them being the British?
And the French. And
we are. Well, the short answer,
American world.
Yeah, well, the short answer is we are trying to, which is right now the United States, for example, has 68,000 plus or minus servicemen and women in Afghanistan. The European members of NATO have probably between 30 and 40,000 servicemen and women. Including the Canadians in Afghanistan. So I think there is a sense of the importance and the desirability of having partners to do all these things. I think, though, we have to face the fact that the Europeans in particular, in lots of cases, lack capacity. They lack the political systems or cultures or now which will support certain things. So they're going to be, uneven partners. There are some increasingly selective, what I call a la carte relationships. And I think that's simply reality. No, it's hard because we live in an era, if I'm right, that the principal problems of the era are global. By definition, you can't manage global problems unilaterally. We need others. No, it's not always going to be militarily. We need others to agree to do something about energy or climate change or disease or proliferation or what have you. So increasingly, the serious foreign policy debate is not between going it alone or doing it with others. It's because there's so little we can do alone. The real question is, how do you do it with others in a way? Who are the others? What's the arrangements? And so forth. And I think that's where foreign policy increasingly takes place. But I think we're entering a period of history where, in each instance, we're not going to be quite sure who we can depend on for what. So, I mean, I've been thinking the analogy, what it reminds me of, it's before there was Little League, there were pickup teams. And I think this is the pickup team period of international relations. So everyone, you don't show up at the field every day with Joe's malt shop on your shirt and you know exactly who's playing shortstop for you that day. But instead, you see who shows up at the field at 3 o'clock and you go, okay, I got you, and you. And I had you last time, so you get them this time. And I think that's increasingly the way the United States is going to have to, and it's imperfect. But I think that's kind of where we are. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Ann Jacobson. It's my husband, Eric. We were students at Disney Kennedy School 20 years ago.
You look much too young.
Um,
I wondered if you could comment on the rising influence of China on the world stage, especially as it relates to Africa and some of the things that they're trying to do there in influence.
What kind of, what grade did you get in the class?
A's, I think.
Typical Harvard professor. Easy grader. Easy grader. China. I think China is one of the amazing stories in the world. Nothing unique to see, nothing original to say on that. But China has changed dramatically. I think people still underestimate how much China has to change. I mean, there are plans to still bring what another 300-400 million people from urban from rural areas into urban areas. China can't sustain the level of economic growth in the way it's done it, given energy and environmental issues. It's got a political overlay, the communist overlay on a political system. So it's, China has lots of issues. China is not yet a great power. It's certainly not a threat in most instances to the United States. I would say, on the other hand, China is an increasingly important power. Between the two of us, we're, say, roughly responsible for nearly half of the world's carbon emissions. China's thirst for energy keeps growing at the rate it's growing. It'll have obvious consequences for world energy availability and price. China's the single most important country for influencing the behavior of North Korea, because two-thirds of North Korea's trade goes through China overland. China will be important vis-a-vis Iran. If China's willing to join sanctions against Iran, it would have, I think, significant impact. China's willingness to continue to absorb enormous amounts of dollars, coming back to what we talked about a few minutes ago. So virtually every area of international relations, China matters. And one of the, I would say the challenge for the United States is to build partnerships with China. So whether it's part of G20s or G2s, or, but essentially to integrate China. My friend Bob Zelik, you know, coined the phrase of making China a stakeholder, to get China to see that its relationship with the world can't be narrowly Chinese, but in a sense China has to increasingly understand that its self-interest is embedded in a larger global condition. I think there's been some progress. China over the last year or two has come a long ways, for example, on the energy and environmental issue. Indeed, it's come so far that China's way ahead of us in some ways now at in promoting investment in and development of various types of alternatives. And we may wonder one day why China has stolen a march on us in that. And it has all the advantages and disadvantages of a top-heavy society, a lot of command stuff, which is good and not so good. But I think, you know, as I look out in the 21st century, this is going to be the most important bilateral relationship in the world. And the ability of the United States and China to essentially, you know, find ways to partner where we can and where we can't, to find ways not to allow the difficulties to spill over, that becomes a real management challenge for the United States and China diplomatically. I think it's manageable. I think it's doable. So I'm fairly upbeat. The relationship's in decent shape today, and we're doing more things with China than we've ever done before. But this is an area of real, you know, diplomatic investment, because as goes China, and as goes the U.S.-China relationship, it will have all sorts of ripple effects. And I think we need to, it's important that we see it not in a narrow, almost old-fashioned way that China's rise and growth is somehow our loss. I think we've got to move away from a kind of, and rather look at it as potentially okay. It's going to happen anyhow. So the real question is, to what extent can we steer it? To what extent can we influence it? To what extent can we work with them? And if we can, the 21st century will turn out to be a far better century than if the United States and China are at loggerheads, which is a real prescription for disaster. How are we doing? We okay? We gotta go.
No, we're going to revert a prescription for disaster.
Okay.
In this right now. We want to say, Richard Haas, I think most of us would play on your pickup team any day. You've been fantastic. Thank you so much for coming. Jim Falk wanted me to give you this tie.
Oh, wow.
It's the official World Affairs Council tie with the time from all over the world.
Very cool.
Now, you'll remember there is a time in the tides of men and women which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. So it's our very good fortune. No, Nancy Marcus wants me to quote Shakespeare. We're really happy to have you here today. It's our great good fortune. Thank you, Arena Fasciano. Stand up, Arena. We thank you for bringing you here.